fight peacefully. Appendix 2, text of Stanford Research Institute film. Throughout mankind's history there has existed a folklore that certain gifted individuals have been capable of producing physical effects by means of some agency generally referred to as psychic or psychoenergetic. Substantiation of such claims by accepted scientific methodology has been slow in coming, but recent laboratory experiments, especially in the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia, and more recently in our own laboratory, have indicated that sufficient evidence does exist to warrant serious scientific investigation. It would appear that experiments could be conducted with scientific rigor to uncover not just a catalogue of interesting events, but rather a pattern of cause-effect relationships of the type that lend themselves to analysis and hypothesis in the forms with which we are familiar in the physical sciences. SRI considers this to be a valid area for scientific inquiry. As scientists, we consider it important to examine various models describing the operation of these effects so that we can determine the relationship between extraordinary human functioning and the physical and psychological laws we presently understand. It is not the purpose of our work at SRI to add to the literature another demonstration of the statistical appearance of these phenomena in the laboratory, but rather we seek to achieve an understanding more compatible with contemporary science and more useful to mankind. This film describes a 5-week investigation conducted at Stanford Research Institute with Uri Geller, a young Israeli. The film portrays experiments that we performed with him just as they were carried out. Each scene has been taken from film footage made during actual experiments. Nothing has been restaged or specially created. It is not the purpose of the film to demonstrate any purported psychic abilities of Mr. Geller, but rather to demonstrate the experiments done with him and his response to the experimental situation. Meet Uri Geller. One of the types of demonstration that Geller likes to do is to sit with a group of people and attempt to send a number to various people in the room. With Uri Geller, this is Edgar Mitchell, who with his eyes covered is trying to pick up the number that Geller is sending. Also, we see Wilbur Franklin, of Kent State, Harold Puthoff and Russell Tugg, of SRI, along with Don Suk, Vice President for Research at SRI. Dr. Suk is trying to receive and then write down the number that Geller is sending. In this case, Suk is successful in picking up the number. Of course, this is not a laboratory experiment, since the activity is totally under Geller's control. It was set as an absolute that experiments, to be worthy, had to be under institute control. Here we show a series of experiments where, previously, 15 drawings were placed in double-sealed envelopes in a safe for which none of the experimenters had the combination. It took signatures of both the key researchers to remove a drawing at random from the collection in the safe. One of the researchers would then, in this case Doug, look at the drawing outside the experimental room, reseal the envelope, enter the experimental room, whence Geller's task was to draw what he perceived in the envelope. This is Geller's representation of what he believed was sealed in the envelope. At no time during these experiments did he have any advance knowledge of the target material. As far as he is concerned, these could be drawings of any kind, whether a design or a representational picture. In fact, this is the most off-target of the drawings that he did. Here, the experiment is repeated, this time with Puthoff as a sender, just to check that the identity of the sender is of no significance in the experiment. Additionally, all experiments are tape-recorded to guard against any verbal cueing on the part of the experimenters. This the drawing that Geller has made to correspond to the target object. The rectangle on the clipboard represents the TV screen in Geller's mind on which he claims to project the image he is trying to draw. As you can see, he is quite elated about getting the right answer. Before he does this, it is usually preceded by several minutes of "I can't do this, it's impossible. I want to stop. Let's wait." Here in the laboratory notebook on the left side of the page you see the original targets, and on the right, Geller's responses. This is not a collection of correct answers out of a long series of correct and incorrect responses. This is actually the total run of pictures in the series. It is interesting that there is often a mirror symmetry. In this particular case, Neither Geller nor the experimenter had knowledge of what the target was. This is a double-blind experiment. Here, on the upper left of the page, is a picture that was brought to SRI by an outside consultant and sealed in his own envelope. Geller's representation is at the lower right. This was by far the most complicated target picture encountered during these experiments. This is a typical target carrier used in the experiments. The inner envelope is opaque in its own right. The outer one is a heavy manila envelope. A floodlight behind these envelopes would not permit the interior to be seen. This type of communication experiment was repeated many other times during the 5 weeks, with Geller choosing to pass about 20% of the time. It is interesting that when he drew his response in this case, he didn't recognize the object as eyeglasses. It seemed to him to be an abstract drawing. In general, these drawing experiments were not double-blind, as one of the experimenters knew what was in the picture in the envelope. Here, however, we present a case of a double-blind experiment, in which someone not associated with the project comes into the experimental room, places an object into a can chosen at random from 10 aluminum cans. Numbered tops are also put on at random. The randomizer then leaves the area, and the experimenters enter the experimental area with Geller, with neither the experimenters nor Geller knowing which can contains the object. In this particular case, the target is a 3/4-inch steel ball which now resides in one of the 10 cans in the box. The 10 cans having been arranged neatly, Geller's task now is to determine which of these 10 cans holds the steel ball bearing. He is not permitted to touch the cans or the table. The experimental protocol is for experimenter to remove the cans one at a time in response to Geller's instructions as he points or calls out a can top number. Eventually there will be just 2 or 3 cans left, and Geller will then indicate both by gesture and in writing which one of the remaining cans contains the target. It is only at the end of the experiment that Geller touches the can that he believes contains the object. The protocol included the possibility that he might touch a can accidentally. In such case, that would have counted as a miss. Here he writes the selected number. This, you might say, is a kind of 10-can Russian roulette. He has made his choice. The steel ball is found. In later repetitions of this same experiment, he was finally weaned away from the dowsing technique where he runs his hands over the cans. He got to the point where he could walk into a room, see the cans lined up on a blackboard sill, and just pick up the one that contained the target. We have no hypothesis at this point as to whether this is a heightened sensitivity of some normal sense, or whether it is some paranormal sense. Now we are repeating the experiment with a different target object. One of these cans is filled with room temperature water. Again, the can was filled by an outside person who randomized the position of the cans. Then the box that contained the cans was rotated by a second person so that there is no one person in the room who knows the location of the target can. As you can see here, there is less hand motion by Geller over the can. The protocol as before involves his calling out the number or pointing and one of the experimenters removing the can at Geller's call. At this point in time he is asked to make his choice both by writing the number down as well as making a selection by hand. You will note that he is making a final test to be sure of his selection. Tentatively, he reaches and having made the selection now looks to see whether water is inside the can. He now waters the plant with the contents of the can. You will note he is very pleased with finding this target because he had doubts at the outset whether he would be able to locate a can filled with water. We repeated this type of experiment 14 times, 5 times involved a target being a small permanent magnet. 5 times also involved a steel ball bearing as the target. Twice the target was water. 2 additional trials were made, one with a paper-wrapped ball bearing and one with a sugar cube. The latter 2 targets were not located. Geller felt that he didn't have adequate confidence as to where they were, and he declined to guess, and passed. On the other 12 targets, the ball bearing, the magnet, and the water, he did make a guess as to the target location and was correct in every instance. In subsequent work with another subject, we found the subject experiencing a highly significant difference in his ability to find the steel ball bearing as compared with finding other targets. The whole array of this run had an a priori probability of 1 part in 10^12 or statistics of a trillion to 1. Here is another double-blind experiment in which a die is placed in a metal file box, both box and die being provided by SRI. The box is shaken up with neither the experimenter nor Geller knowing where the die is or which face is up. This is a live experiment that you see. In this case, Geller guessed that a 4 was showing but first he passed because he was not confident. You will note he was correct and he was quite pleased to have guessed correctly. But this particular test does not enter into our statistics. The previous runs of 10 can we let gave a result whose probability due to chance alone is 1 part in 10^12. We decided at the outset to carry out the die-in-box experiment until we got to a million to 1 odds, at which time the experiment was terminated. Out of 10 tries in which he passed twice and guessed 8 times, the 8 guesses were correct. And that gave us a probability of about 1 in a million. We would point out again, there were no errors in the times he made a guess. This is the first of 2 experiments in psychokinesis. Here a 1 gram weight is being placed on an electrical scale. It is then covered by an aluminum can and by a glass cylinder to eliminate deflection due to air currents. The first part of our protocol involves tapping the bell jar, next tapping the table, then kicking the table. And finally jumping on the floor, with a record made of what these artifacts looked like so that they could be distinguished from signals. In tests following this experimental run, a magnet was brought near the apparatus, static electricity was discharged against parts of the apparatus, and controlled runs of day-long operation were obtained. In no case were artifacts obtained which in any way resembled the signals produced by Geller. Nor could anyone else duplicate the effects. The bottom 4 signals show the type of artifact that results from tapping or kicking the table. They are small AC signals with a time constant characteristic of the apparatus. The upper 2 traces, on the other hand, are apparently due to Geller's efforts. They are single-sided signals, one corresponding to a 1,500 mg weight decrease. The other corresponding to an 800 mg weight increase. Those types of single-sided signals were never observed as artifacts with any other stimuli. We have no ready hypothesis on how these signals might have been produced. The width of the signals produced by Geller was about 200 milliseconds. The chart ran at 1 mm per second. It was of interest to note that Geller's performance improved over the period of experimentation. Starting with 50 mg deflections and driving at 1,500 mg. In this experiment Geller is attempting to influence the magnetometer either directly or by generating a magnetic field. The full-scale sensitivity of the instrument is 0.3 of a Gauss, and, as is clear in this instance, his hands are open. Throughout the experiment, his hands do not come into contact with the instrument. The magnetometer itself was used as a probe to go over his hands and person to make sure that there were no magnetic objects in his hands or on him. Here you see substantial fluctuations both to the left and to the right, almost full scale in certain cases, on the magnetometer meter. These fluctuations are sometimes uncorrelated with the motions of his hands. This is the chart recording of the magnetometer fluctuations produced by Geller. We see here full-scale fluctuations of 0.3 of a Gauss, which is a significant magnetic field, comparable to the Earth's field. After each of these experiments we would in general discuss the results with Geller, show him the strip chart recording, and talk about the significance of his experiments. He was very interested in the experiments we were doing because he had never taken part in laboratory experiments of this kind before. The following is an experiment which in retrospect we consider unsatisfactory, as it didn't meet our protocol standards. Here the task is to deflect the compass needle which, indeed, Geller does. Before and after the experiment, he was gone over with a magnetometer probe and his hands were photographed from above and below during and following the experiment so that we are sure there were no obvious pieces of metal or magnets in his possession. However, according to our protocol, if we could in any way debunk the experiment and produce the effects by any other means, then that experiment was considered null and void even if there were no indications that anything untoward happened. In this case, we found later that these types of deflections could be produced by a small piece of metal, so small in fact that they could not be detected by the magnetometer. Therefore, even though we had no evidence of this, we still considered the experiment inconclusive and an unsatisfactory type of experiment altogether. A look at the lower mirror affords one a best view. It can be seen that his hands are completely exposed to photography from above and below with different cameras. These are a series of unconfirmed physical effects that need further investigation. One of Geller's main attributes that had been reported to us was that he was able to bend metal from a distance without touching it. In the laboratory, we did not find him able to do so. In a more relaxed protocol, he was permitted to touch the metal, in which case, as you will see in the film, the metal is indeed bent. However, it becomes clear in watching this demonstration on film that simple photo interpretation is insufficient to determine whether the metal is bent by normal or paranormal means. In the laboratory, these spoon bending experiments were continuously filmed and videotaped. It is evident that sometime during the photographic period this stainless steel spoon became bent. However, unlike the things we have heard about Geller, it was always necessary for him in the experimental situation to have physical contact with the spoon or for that matter any other object that he bends. It is not clear whether the spoon is being bent because he has extraordinarily strong fingers and good control of micromanipulatory movements or whether, in fact, the spoon turns to plastic in his hands, as he claims. Here are a number of the spoons that were bent by one means or another during the course of our experiments. There is no doubt that the spoons were bent. The only doubt remains as to the manner of their bending. Similarly, we have rings that were bent by Mr. Geller. The rings that were bent are shown here. The copper ring at the left and the brass ring at the right were manufactured at SRI and measured to require 150 pounds force to bend them. These rings were in Geller's hand at the time they were bent. This brief recap is to remind you of those experiments we feel were best controlled. They are the three perception experiments, including the hidden drawings in envelopes, the double-blind hidden object experiments, and the double-blind die-in-the-box experiment. The two psychokinetic experiments, the depression or raising of a weight on an electrical scale and the deflection of the magnetometer, also do not seem to admit of any ready counter hypothesis. What we've demonstrated here are the experiments that we performed in the laboratory and should not be interpreted as proof of psychic functioning. Indeed, a film never proves anything. Rather, this film gives us the opportunity to share with the viewer observations of phenomena that in our estimation clearly deserve further study. Appendix 3, Clock, Time, and Prayer. On the instructions of Spectra to pray for peace whenever my watch stopped, see page 136. Tel Aviv, Israel, December 21 to the 24th, 1971. On December 21, 1971, as I drove to Uri's apartment in Tel Aviv, I started my prayer. I had got into the habit now of going into prayer consciousness as soon as the watch stopped. When I arrived, Uri looked at the stopped watch, put his hand over it, and it started to run, at 1:21 p.m., local time. We discussed the experience he had had with the brown suitcase. There was no question that it was my suitcase which was stored at the Sharon Hotel. Later on when I checked the storage closet, I found my Tapelite suitcase in place, and not in any way changed. We could not come to any conclusion as to the meaning of this event. I felt that it was only an assurance of continuing presence to help allay our recurring doubts. Feeling very tired from my all-night vigil, I left shortly to return to my hotel. I lay down on the sofa in my room, and I remember looking at the watch as I was dozing off to sleep. I remember seeing it come to a halt at 2:45 and 45 seconds p.m., just before sleep overtook me. I awoke at 4:39 p.m. electric clock time, and saw that my watch was indeed standing still, at 2:45 and 45 seconds. Fortunately, I was alone, with no one to disturb me, and was able seriously to apply myself to peace prayers. The watch remained stopped for 21 hours and 27 minutes. I did the best I could to stay awake and keep the prayer for peace and love for Mr. Sadat going. However, there were distractions. At 10:15 a.m. on December 22, I turned on the RCA radio in the room. There was only one station on the air, at 760 KC, very loud and clear, and all in Hebrew. All other stations were absent on this radio. When I checked the other stations with my Sony battery radio, they were all on the air normally. I found at 10:49 a.m. that all other stations suddenly came through normally on the hotel radio. I reasoned that I was being shown yet another aspect of the intelligent control over electronic communications systems. Reuven came to see me at noon. At 12:12 p.m. electric clock time, my watch began to run normally while he and I were looking at it. I left the hotel at about 1 p.m. to go into Tel Aviv to attend to some business at the American Embassy. While I was at the embassy, my watch stopped at 3:45 and 45 seconds. But I had no local time clock to check against when this occurred. After sitting by the seashore for some 3 hours in quiet prayer, I went to see Yuri. While with him, at 6:06 p.m., local time, my watch started to run again by itself. We left his apartment at 6:50 p.m. to drive to a place near Rehovot where he had a show in a theater. As we drove in the darkness, a cold, driving rain beat against the car. We were discussing our deep concern for the danger of a war. I was in the middle of the following sentence: "I believe that Mr. Sadat will make a decision tomorrow about going to war," when the car horn gave one short blast of sound, all by itself. Yuri and I looked at each other, realizing that every word of ours was somehow being overheard. A few minutes later, the headlights switched off by themselves, forcing us to stop. A few minutes later, the lights switched on by themselves. The show was in a large theater with no heat, and the feeling of cold had a bone-chilling effect. The crowd was young, rather wild, and very noisy. At 8:30 p.m. the show started. My watch stopped at 5:45 and 45 seconds. While the variety show went on, I pretended to be asleep, but was in fact engaged in my peace prayer. Yuri's part of the show was on from 11 to 11:30. During this period I had the feeling that the power of my prayer was being amplified. We left the theater at 11:30, and when Yuri and I met, my watch began to run again. On the road back to Tel Aviv, the car lights suddenly went off, and the engine went off suddenly. We parked at the edge of the road and waited. In 2 minutes an invisible hand turned the lights on again. It was then that we discovered that the ignition key had been turned off by counterclockwise rotation. This was how the engine had been turned off by our invisible friends. We drove back to Tel Aviv without any further occurrences, except that at some point during the drive, I do not know when, my watch had been stopped at 7:45 and 45 seconds. Because of this incident and earlier such incidents, I borrowed Ori's very fine Certina watch, just to have a reference clock on me. When I returned to the Sharon Hotel at 1 a.m., December 23, 1971, I had no choice but to resume my prayers, since the watch was still stopped. The watch remained stopped until 10:04 a.m., December 23, and until that moment I remained vigilant at my prayers. I no longer suffered from exhaustion. It was as if I were drawing on some reserve of energy. When the watch started running, there was not time to go to sleep. I had to go to Tel Aviv to have a meeting with one of the Israeli army officers. I got there early for my appointment so that I could have breakfast. As I was eating breakfast and reading the newspaper, I got an impulse at 12:03 p.m. Certina time, to stare at my Geneva watch, which was now running normally. The minute and hour hands were almost precisely at 9:45 setting, and the small second hand was coming around clockwise from the 22nd marker. As I watched this second hand, it moved normally until it got to the 45 second marker, and there it stopped instantly before my eyes. This is the first time I had ever seen the hands come to a stop instantly under direct observation. I checked the operation of Uri's Certina on my right wrist. It was operating normally. Although I should have prayed then and there, I could not, for at this moment, the army officer arrived. We met for some 30 minutes and parted. I regret that I am not able to disclose the nature of our conversation, except to say that the coming war was discussed. I then went to see Yuri at his apartment and talked about my all-night vigil. He was sympathetic. He wanted to do an experiment with the two watches. Both were placed face up on the table, reading, Geneve, 9:45 and 45 seconds, stopped Certina, 2:00 p.m. Normory placed a sheet of paper over the two watches. Just then the local air raid sirens went off with a crescendo of sound, just a practice alert. The paper was lifted off. The Geneva was running normally again. I left shortly thereafter to take care of some business at the National Car Rental Office in Tel Aviv. While I was sitting there at 3 o'clock, Certina time, my Geneva watch stopped at 10:45 and 45 seconds. So I drove to my hotel immediately to begin my prayers. This time I sat facing Egypt and facing the sea for many hours. Yuri walked into my room at 9:29 p.m., placed his hand over my Geneva watch, and it started to run immediately. Without knowing why, Yuri was unconsciously being directed to come along and release me from each of my long prayer vigils. Yuri remained with me during the next hour. It was during this hour, from 9:30 to 10:30 p.m., December 23, 1971, that Uri became Omegas, a man sure of his powers from on high. It began with Uri testing his power on the silver compass which was lying on my study table. He had just started my watch with casual ease, as I have just described. He placed his hand over the compass, and the needle literally spinned. He took his hand away, and as we talked about the ease with which he now moved a compass compared to his efforts just 1 month ago, the compass vanished before our eyes. We searched the entire apartment, and I found the compass lying on the floor of the bathroom. I put it back on the desk. As Uri and I stood at the desk, he opened the desk drawer and almost unconsciously picked up the Minox flash gun which had appeared in his hand on December 20th. He took the flash out of the leather case and asked me to tell him once again the story, and I assured him that this flash gun had not belonged to me before, that it was a gift from an unknown source. I handed him the flash gun, and he put it back in its leather case and dropped it into the drawer. A few minutes later Uri was drawn back to the desk drawer and opened it while I watched him. He picked up the leather case. "My God, it's gone!" he shouted. I opened the case. The flash gun had indeed vanished. Yuri was feeling his power as a newfound gift. He said that he now consciously wanted the flash gun to reappear. He placed the empty leather case inside my heavy large steel camera case and snapped all the locks shut on it at 9:50 p.m. At 9:55 p.m. we opened the steel camera case, and there was the Minox flash gun, neatly placed inside its leather case. Yuri was having great fun with his newfound power. He was holding an unlit cigar in his left hand as he said, "I wish I could now make something disappear from my hand." As he said this, the cigar instantly vanished from his hand. We laughed uproariously at what had just happened. It was like some vaudeville act. 2 minutes later the cigar reappeared on the microphone part of the Sony TC-120 tape recorder, which was on a table. I admonished Uri about how careful he had to be from now on with respect to his thoughts. He had just expressed a simple wish, and it had been fulfilled. It was like rubbing Aladdin's lamp. But we knew that our genie was an intelligence from a superior civilization. Uri said he would be very, very careful about his thoughts from now on. We had a serious talk about the war threat. I said, "There are only about 72 hours left. I wish we would be given more information now." Yuri said, "Don't worry, it will come, if it is needed. But I don't think there is going to be a war. I feel it now." As we discussed this war problem, we began to look at my Geneva watch lying on the table. The minute and hour hand had reached the 11:45 and 45 seconds position. We looked at the second hand and saw it go from 42 to 43 seconds to 45 seconds, then it stopped. The 13 o'clock time was 10:30 p.m. Uri left a few minutes later. I settled down to a long prayer vigil. But I did not know how long it was going to be this time. It was to last 40 hours and 4 minutes before my watch started to run again. As the hours wore on, and Christmas Eve approached, my thoughts turned more and more to the prince, or peace.